Welcome to Britain's only weekly FM radio programme about transport and design. Hello, I'm Mark Ovenden. We're chatting art, transport, communications, history, that's C-A-T-C-H. It's the Catchcast. In this edition, how do you find the bus that you need, especially when you're a visitor to a new place? Today's guest is the author of a lovely new book on bus maps. Welcome to the Catchcast, John Davis.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being here, John, and we really are going to discuss your excellent new book in a bit. When did you first get fascinated by buses and maps?
I've always been fascinated. I've had two passions in my life, buses and maps, and they overlap beautifully. But yes, ever since childhood, I used to stand and look at buses and draw maps, so they come together, yes.
You made a marvellous chalk map, didn't you, when you were a kid, of the route to your grandma's house?
Yeah, I found this photograph in the family album, and clearly that's a demonstration that really at a very early age, I was perhaps 4 or 5 when I drew that. We lived in Lancaster, and it was immediately post-war. To travel to my grandma in Manchester, there was a bus, there was a train, there was another bus, and it was a journey. It was a journey that I grew to love. Yes, clearly in that particular example, I drew it on a board and was very pleased with it. So, yes, I've always loved this idea of travelling and this idea that it's how places relate to each other. Go on an aeroplane or even on a tube train, you start at one point, you end somewhere else, and you don't really know how they relate. Travel over ground, travel on a bus, travel on a train, walk. You see places in relation to each other. And that whole thing of the spatial thing fascinates me. The relationship between places, and maps are glorious for that, and it's something you cannot describe in words. A map just shows you instantly how places relate.
That's a beautiful way of looking at it. I really love that. And so did that understanding of how important maps were, is that what made you start collecting transport maps, John?
It must have been, mustn't it? Yes, I've got ones in my collection from certainly before the age of 10. So I must have been a real pain in the bottom to my parents. I would say, oh, stop, let's go in the transport office, let's go into the bus station, let's pick up a map and a timetable. But I did do, and I have them, so that's what happened.
Yeah, I first got my collection going when I was a kid. My mum used to give me old tube maps when I was on the train with her so that I would be distracted. And I would just sit for hours looking at the map and not then annoy her or the other passengers. I believe that you started your working life there as a surveyor. When was that, and what kind of projects were you working on? Anything to do with mapping at all?
Becoming a surveyor was a sort of obvious outlet. I've got a passion for the outdoor life. I love walking. I love being out of doors. And, of course, I like maps and drawing maps. So becoming a surveyor was an obvious career choice for me. But, in fact, I became a quantity surveyor working on building sites throughout the north of England and in Scotland. The best project I ever worked on was the Aviemore Centre. So this is the late 60s, and there was a huge ski development in Invernessshire, in the Cairngorms, and I was surveyor on that site. When that came to an end, I felt it was time for me to settle down and perhaps have a steadier life. The trouble with being a surveyor of building sites is it's boom and bust. You're very busy, and then the projects come to an end and you're kicking around wondering what happens next.
You jumped ship from surveying into computer programming at quite an early part of their development, didn't you?
Well, exactly. The timing fitted beautifully. It turned out that I was ready to settle down to a new sort of career, and it was just a time of decimalisation. Computers at that stage were huge things, filled up a room with a big air conditioning system and all the rest of it. But they were in use for particularly accounting systems. There was invoicing and payroll and things like that. And they all had pounds, shillings and pence, which had to be converted. So there was a big demand for computer programming. And I thought, well, that's something I can see a future in computer programming. I was 10 years older than other entrants into that profession at that time, but that didn't matter. But it developed from there because I'd got business experience and life experience more so than my other fellow starters. I got far more interested in system design. It wasn't so much writing the programs. It was thinking what systems could do for you. And that's really how my career progressed as a system designer and developer. I knew what programmers could do, and I could see in the real world how you could make a difference with computing. So that was, so that was about 1970 or something. That was then my career for the rest of my working life.
And I understand that, skipping ahead to the 1990s, that you came up with some software that was a huge help to bus operators. Tell us about how that worked and why your bus map collection and interest was part of that.
So in my career as a system designer, I worked for other companies and I also set up my own business. But I had clients really many parts of the world, or throughout Europe anyway, and in the United States. So I was designing a variety of systems for a variety of customers. And they were bespoke systems. A customer would say, this is what I want to achieve, and I would work with him to achieve that. And I decided it would be quite a nice thing to develop a software package. And if you found an industry where that package was applicable across a whole number of customers, and preferably one that nobody else had already thought of, then that was perhaps a lucrative way forward. Because I was interested in buses, and because the bus industry, it's post-deregulation, and suddenly there's hundreds of small bus companies which replaced, well, the National Bus Company, basically. And people were coming to run these businesses who'd think they were used to having data. The bus industry ran on seat of pants information, really. But people coming into the industry didn't know that. There were electronic ticket machines, I was aware of that. And they were used to cashing purposes. Check on the driver, did he hand over all the cash he'd collected? And I thought, well, actually, these ticket machines are collecting a huge amount of potentially really valuable information. Nobody's doing anything with it. All we need is a way of storing that information and delving into it. What you now call data mining, it wasn't called that then, but the more information you could collect, and this was to do with passengers, it was fares paid, but it was more than that. It was, where did they get on? What time did they get on? What service was it? What bus was it? Where did they get off? And then you could collect a lot of information, passenger travel, and of course, you know, the power of that information, you got a history of it, and you've got technology that can store it and search it rapidly and produce meaningful output. Then that was a winner, and nobody else was doing it. So suddenly there was the scope for me to travel around the country, which I like doing, visit bus companies, which is always fascinating. And whilst it was there, oh, is that one of your latest maps? May I have one of those? And so that way I amassed quite a collection of up-to-date maps to complement the ones that I'd collected in childhood and other times.
Fantastic.
Collecting them from the very operators.
Oh, John, we're going to cover your book in a bit, but can you tell us about what you did for members of a cartography society?
Oh, certainly. The Cartographic Society is the Charles Close Society for the Study of Ordnance Survey Maps. Charles Close was a Director General of the Ordnance Survey in the mid-20th century, and he's the person who pivoted Ordnance Survey from being a military organisation to one producing maps for civilian population. So very influential in the Ordnance Survey history. And the society was formed about when the 1980s, it's now about 50 years old, and we have about 700 members interested in Ordnance Survey maps, but also interested in the wider story of maps altogether. I was a member of the committee of the society. I developed the website for them. I was visits organiser. We used to visit other national mapping organisations, Isle of Man, Ireland, Channel Islands, and various parts of Europe. So we had fascinating accumulation of knowledge about maps and ordnance survey maps and the wider mapping types of publications. And latterly, the society started doing Zoom talks. I was asked to do a Zoom talk, and I chose bus maps. And I did about an hour's talk on bus maps. And from that, the idea developed that maybe this would make a book.
Ah, right. So that's where you got the idea from. Today, we're with John Davies, who spent a lifetime collecting bus maps. And we're going to hear about his wonderful new book on the subject in a moment. But John, you also spent some time working in Lapvia, I believe.
Yes, I did. I told you about the system I developed for bus operators. Round about the millennium, the technology was quite old hat by then, and I was getting old hat myself by then. So I'd sold on the system, and the people who adopted it decided to have it redeveloped, which they did in Latvia, because the very highly educated program is in Latvia. So I was asked to go to Latvia, spent about a year there on and off, And I went in the map shop in Riga, because what else do you do when you're in a city? But then I discovered maps of London and elsewhere that had been developed by the Soviet military during the Cold War. And they were secret maps, they're in Cyrillic, and they're very detailed and very beautiful. And I was fascinated by these, so I inquired more about the shop, and they told me after the Latvians had become liberated from Russia, from Soviet Union, in the early 90s, these maps had just been abandoned in a warehouse in Latvia, and the shop was selling them. So I frequented that shop over the period of about a year, buying up as many of these as I could smuggle home on the aeroplane. And I realised that very few other people knew anything about these maps at all. Mm. They were not only of Britain, but they were of all European cities and American cities, well, world cities. Large-scale maps, 1 to 10,000, 1 to 25,000 city plans, but also smaller-scale topographic maps of vast areas of the world. So I collected many of these, and that led into a collaboration with an academic friend of mine, Alex Kent, and we wrote a book about these maps, and nobody had done such a thing. And that book came out in 2017, and is still a Sydney seller. So I was very, very pleased with that. It was a good achievement.
That's the How the Soviet Union Secretly Mapped the World, is it?
The Red Atlas, How the Soviet Union Secretly Mapped the World. And it's still up there on Amazon, and it's still selling. So that was a very pleasing project.
Oh, lucky man. I'm glad your books are still selling. And during all of that time of collecting those Soviet maps, were you still collecting bus maps as well? I mean, how many do you think you have now, John?
I collect all kinds of maps. I'm a bit of a map squirrel, or a mapaholic, I think probably is the word. But as to bus maps, yes, I kept my collection going. It came to well over 1,000.
Wow.
Well over 1,000. I'm using the past tense now because I don't still have them. And I realised that they're ephemera. People throw them away. A bus map's only useful while it's current. Well, all maps, that's true. But bus maps in particular, because things change quite frequently. So people throw them away. But if you don't throw them away, then you end up with a huge collection of them, which, if you have them long enough, turn out to be really very interesting, or the basis for telling a story anyway. Well, I donated my collection of Russian maps to the Bodleian Library in Oxford. Mm. And I donated my collection of bus maps to the National Library of Scotland and to the Cambridge University Library. I was very interested in them going into the public domain and being available for future researchers.
Very good.
Accompanied by the book. So that's where the maps are now.
Before you gave them all away, you had this monumental collection. Talk us through the idea you had of making them all into a book. Surely there's already been a book of bus maps, hasn't there?
Do you know, there hasn't.
Oh.
There's plenty of books about railways. There's plenty of books about railway maps. And you yourself, Mark, have done a splendid Metro Maps book and others.
Thank you.
And there's plenty of books about buses as kind of shiny objects that drive around on the road. But as far as I can discover, nobody's ever written a book about bus maps.
Wow.
So the process was this. To make life easy for my family when I expire, which I expect to do in the near future.
it comes to us all, John.
Inevitably. Yeah, I decided to part with the maps, but I was very keen on the idea of having them scanned first. And I'd done that with the Russian maps. I rented a scanner and scanned all my Russian maps. And it was a big project and it was very expensive. But I wanted to do the same for the bus maps, and I looked for an easier way of doing it. And I found a website called Timetable World, and I said to Matshaw, would you be interested in scanning my maps for your website? And, of course, he was delighted at the idea. And so the maps were all scanned. They went up on Matt's website. And that made it easier for me to give them away, because I now had a copy on my computer. And it made it very easy to do further research, because I could bring them up on the screen. I could see them all on the computer, which made any further research or any writing very much more simple.
And your relationship with Timetable World ended up being very useful for you, didn't it?
I'd given the talk to the Charles Close Society, as I mentioned. So I'd got this idea in my head that a book would be good. And I had the same experience as I had with the Russian maps book. I approached publishers who were in that sort of market, and I don't think any of them even answered. Oh. Publishers must be inundated with unsolicited offers. They must be absolutely overwhelmed with people who think they can write a book. So anyway, I'd been rejected or not even noticed by British publishers for the Busmaps book. But Matt said, well, why don't we do it together? And I thought, oh, okay, let's just do that. So he and I just sat down and planned the book. We now had all the scans and all the pictures, with 1,000 of them, more than 1,000. So we got plenty of pictures to choose from. And it all happened very quickly from there, just a matter of 2 or 3 months to put the whole thing together. And Matt did all the design, editing and negotiating with printers and all of that side of it and distribution. And I did chose the pictures and wrote the words.
Well, John, I'm holding the end result in my hand. It's a very hefty and impressive tome. So we've been hearing about your huge collection and the groundwork for your book, but obviously you couldn't fit 1,000 maps into one book. So I wonder if you can talk us through a little bit about what the process was of deciding what went in and what had to be left out, John.
It's a bit of a tough one, but I set myself a few ground rules, one of which I wanted a complete spread of British geography. So I'll make sure there's a map included from everywhere in Britain, every county, all the major cities and towns right across, including Northern Ireland and, of course, Scotland, Wales and England. So that was one criterion. Another was I wanted a very wide variety of maps. And this is really where it gets interesting to me. If you think about Ordnance Survey maps, they have a very well thought through specification. They've got conventions. If you understand the colours and the symbols used on Ordnance Survey maps, for example, then you can instantly read an Ordnance Survey map. And they all look the same. They're of different places, obviously, but the way they're done, the information they present, and how you understand that information is standard, it's done. Now, bus maps are nothing like that. Every one of them is an individual production in its own right. It may or may not use colour. It may or may not show any landscape or topography. Some of them look like a tube map. They're just a diagram of lines. Some of them will show tourist attractions. Some of them will try to indicate the frequency of the service. A wide variety of what the map looks like, what the map is trying to do, and how successful it is at that. That then gave me a criteria that we should show a real cross-section of all the different types of ways of presenting information.
Right.
And then that could be quite a good narrative, really, of saying, well, look how this one has shown there's 5 buses a day and so on. That was another of the criteria. And then another one was that some of the older maps, we start at the beginning of the 20th century with London General Omnibus Company of 1910, so some of the older maps were really worth having in anyway. The early bus and tram maps, they got in. So it was a bit difficult, and there were some maps that I would have loved to put in, but just couldn't. Every one of these maps tells a story.
Mm. That is always a problem, isn't it? When you've got so many things that you want to put into a book, is how do you decide what to leave out?
Yeah.
Looking through your book, the maps really come into their own during what you call the peak bus era, don't they? Tell us about some beautiful examples from inside the book, please, John.
Okay, well, interestingly, we have to talk about London. The London General Omnibus Company had the first maps that we've got in the book, and they really established the idea of a bus map. Their maps were very attractive. They're the forebears, if that's the word, of London bus maps ever after. Red lines were showing where the bus goes. They've got colours where the parks are. They're dated 1912, 1914. There's a series of them. And they were published every month. And they would have a calendar of events for the month.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were in a nice folder. They had them in boxes on the buses. Passengers would pick one up. And even on the front cover, there was what looks like the roundel that we're familiar with London Transport, a circle with a line through it. And then London progressed, although politically things changed quite a lot. In 1933, the London Passenger Transport Board took over all the buses and trams, but they continued to produce really good quality maps and a whole variety of maps of London. They went through different designs, but always London had the best map, had really good maps, until 2016, when they suddenly stopped.
Oh.
And the reason they gave was, well, they're expensive to produce. People use online systems now anyway. And nobody wants to know all of London. All you want to know is your little local bit. Now, I would quarrel with some of those arguments.
Absolutely, what a shame.
But anyway, the only maps they ever produced after that were the tube map and things called spider maps. It looks like a little tube diagram of a locality with the bus numbers on and the bus stops named. So that's what London did, and that's all represented in the book. And nationally, a similar story. So we've got them from other cities, similar sort of progression as London's. Queen Elizabeth II was crowned in 1953, and that seemed to generate an era of post-war prosperity in Britain. But not a lot of families had cars, and the bus really was the way people travelled, go out for evening entertainment, for commuting to their places of work, for shopping. All the family used the bus, and the buses were prolific everywhere you went. Every town you visited, the buses were different. I lived in Bradford at that stage, and in Bradford the buses were blue, but if you went to Leeds the buses were green, and then in Halifax they were orange, and in Huddersfield they were red, and so on. So they were very different, but they were also very smartly turned out, and they were a real symbol of civic pride. So buses were very distinctive wherever you went, and the maps that were produced at that time were equally distinctive. Now, all of that vanished over time, but that period in the 50s was, I call it peak bus, because that very prosperity led really to the demise of that circumstance, because families got cars and out-of-town shopping centres were built. So people were car-based and commuting was different. Places of work were different, shopping was different, and buses went into decline. In 1968, the Transport Act created the National Bus Company in an effort to bring all the bus companies into a single state ownership, trying to lead to and services more appropriate to that age. So then we had the nationalised period, and the National Bus Company developed stars and mapping, a double N symbol that became familiar and that National Express still use.
We had that period of, as you call it, nationalisation, but then we went into deregulation. And after that, there weren't any national bus maps produced to speak of, were they? But you make a special mention of Southern Vectis for attempting one.
Absolutely. So 1986, the politics have changed massively by then, and state ownership, all that was removed. The National Bus Company was split into a million fragments, all sold off almost depot by depot to local management. And any idea of cohesion or comprehensive service or integrated services, that vanished in the sense that we were now very individual local enterprise. Southern Vectis on the Isle of Wight were very enterprising. They were privatised and they had, of course, the island to themselves. But they also realised that nationally there was no information. And for a few years, they produced a national timetable, National Bus Services.
Wow.
And also a lovely map of National Express coaches. And that enterprise lasted, or that mapping lasted for a while, but that came to an end.
Do we still need properly designed and printed maps? You mentioned that London stopped doing them. They just do the spider maps. It's the handheld age. Do we still need printed maps, do you think, John?
Well, I would argue strongly, yes, we do. The motorist uses a sat-nav. It says, I'm here and I want to get to there. Tell me what to do. A walker can do the same, a journey by bus or train, in exactly the same way. You don't need to know anything. Just type in place and the time you want to go. But if you're a bit more interested, if I visited the Isle of Wight, I would like to spread out a map of the island and see what's possible. Where can I catch a bus? Where could I walk? Where could I create a walk to link to, you know, get off a bus here and get another bus or a train or something somewhere else. So we lose spatial awareness by using our devices. We lose a sense of reality and relationship, and that the map will show us everything where I am and related to where everything else is. And I will spot things of interest if I look at a map. So I would argue that you need both.
Good point.
The digital revolution has brought massive benefits. It's brilliant. What's at your fingertips? You don't get lost anymore. It's all there. But you don't have this sense of reality, of place, sense of what I call spatial awareness, but this sense of place, I think, is so important.
So there you have it. A man who helped play a huge part in the way that we use technology says, yes, we do need technology, but we will also need a good printed map. John, thank you. I'm sure we could go on talking about this for hours. It's been a privilege to chat with such an esteemed fellow map enthusiast. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
And thank you for the opportunity, Mark. Bye.
Hope you've enjoyed listening to John Davies as much as I have. You can find his book, The Rise and Demise of the Bus Map, at www.timetableworld.com. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please do join us then.